You're listening to Ink Studs on CITR 101.9 FM. That has got to be one of the gentlest ways I've been brought on air. My guest this week is Gabby Schultz, a.k.a. Ken Doll. How are you doing today, Gabby?
Hello. I'm doing great, thanks.
Tell us about that song we just listened to.
Gabby Pahanui, and it was probably the most different. That was probably the hardest segue between songs from the last song that I think it could possibly happen. It was entirely appropriate somehow. It worked. Gabby Pahanui is sort of the grandfather of or the father of the new traditional Hawaiian music in the 60s and 70s. And he was he kind of brought it out of the back to its roots after a long, long hiatus. Like apparently nobody sang Hawaiian lyrics and Hawaiian music and for popular music before he started doing it, and then it seems weird to me that wasn't the case, but apparently he didn't even know how to speak Hawaiian, or he didn't know it that well, and so but he learned it as a way of just sort of reconnecting to Hawaiian history and his roots, and I could talk for hours about Hawaii, I guess. I'm a little homesick.
Although you were just saying it's very hot where you are right now, so.
It's sort of like Hawaii, only nastier. Yeah, I'm in New York right now, and it's really hot. I mean, it's great. I actually kind of like it. I should probably go outside at some point.
Well, you don't have the as much of a breeze as you'd probably get in Hawaii.
Yeah, that's it. I realized when I was biking down the bridge, Williamsburg Bridge, there's like this long downhill part, and I realized that it's actually just like Hawaii when you're on a bike going downhill. It's just humid, but with the breeze. Yeah, Hawaii's, I mean, you know, whatever. I you can't complain about it. It's perfect.
Not a lot of cartoonists from Hawaii.
There actually, Kaz Strepek is also from Hawaii.
That's
right. Aaron Yu.
I forgot about Kaz. And another New Yorker, Arkiko Johnson.
Arkiko Johnson, right, from Maui, yeah. I
forgot about
out there.
Kaz. He lives in Seattle, too, so he's not very far from here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's just down the road. Yeah, we were pals. We actually went to our first comic convention together. We went to Ape, and I think it was 2004, maybe?
Wow.
And we were just a couple of nobodies, it was amazing. He instantly, everybody was just adored Kaz, you know, because his stuff is amazing. But the night before we went to the convention, we were both sitting in the, you know, we were laying down on this inflatable mattress at his sister's house in San Francisco, and he's like, he was really nervous that nobody would like his comics, and it was such a cartoonist moment, you know, and we're all so self-deprecating and insecure. I was really happy to have him be proved wrong.
Indeed. Indeed. It's true on so many levels. When did you first start doing comics? I know you came from a zine background. Were you doing comic-y zines? Were you doing zines? Or were you doing comics and hanging out with
zines? Yeah, I was always drawn. I guess I started drawing in... Well, it's a long story, but I guess I'm pretty old. I'm like 37 years old. So I did my first mini comic in 1993 or 4, and that was after I had, you know, spent a couple of years worshipping Robert Crumb and thinking that it was really cool to draw comics about your life with a lot of cross-hatching. I guess a lot of people were doing that, excuse me, back then, because there wasn't the internet. And it was a totally different world. It just it seemed like that was something that you would just do. You would draw a comic and you would send it to 50 people through Fact Sheet 5, and that, you know, that would be your way of connecting to the world, especially if you lived in Hawaii, which was sort of a rock in the middle of the ocean. And it was a great way to feel like I wasn't all alone in the world. I did a few issues of that. It seemed to get a really good response, and I seemed to improve really fast. I guess, I don't know, the 90s were like that. Like, it was mm-hmm. so easy to... There were so many amazing cartoonists that were starting work then. It was so inspiring. And they were all really accessible, like, through the Fact Sheet 5. I remember I have letters from all sorts of cartoonists who are really big now. Like, Adrian Tomine was just doing a mini-comic, and... Dave Cooper had sent me a really... We used to write, and, you know, like, of course, John Porcellino was mm-hmm. huge back then. And, as I mentioned, Jim Woodring.
He was... I've been, like, reading up on a lot of, like, the early Jim Woodring days, and he had, like, he'd make weird little things and sell it, if I remember right.
Yeah, he used to have a catalog of all this stuff that he would sell, and, it's like this weird... thing you looked into, and it was some kind of mirror device that was supposed to drive you insane if you looked into it. And it was like $300. I should have bought one. And he gave you for free. He would draw you a Jiva portrait, which was like a portrait of your soul. If you wrote him a letter with things about you, he would send you back this portrait of a, you know, one of those weird sort of sea cucumber looking things. And it was actually really, it was really depressing, because I wrote him and asked for one and wrote him some stuff, and he wrote me a really nice letter back, and he's like, I enclosed it. He said something about, the way he wrote it, it sounded like he had actually sent me my Jiva portrait, which I had requested, but the only other piece of paper in the letter was a blank sheet of paper, and it was like, was he telling me that I had no soul? Or, like, I held it over a stove thinking maybe it was, like, drawn with lemon juice or something. Nothing. It was really disturbing.
That's amazing.
But the letter was so nice that it didn't seem like he was saying that I had no soul. But to this day, I always think, like, maybe he's telling me something.
Do you still have the blank piece of paper?
I do, yeah.
It's one of those things where it's like, you know, you're going to have no use for it, but you can't really get rid of it.
Yeah, this is too important.
I'm curious if there was much of a zine culture within Hawaii itself, or you're pretty...
There was actually I guess it was probably the same as everywhere. There was in the mid-90s and even in the late-90s, basically until the internet happened, that was... It really blew up around then. I guess, like, probably like everywhere else, 90 to 95 to 99% of all of it was just really bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, that's, what do you expect? I mean, that's, it's, I don't know, it's, there's just no gatekeepers. Like, yeah, anyone can do it, and sometimes people do it for the wrong reasons. But it was still unusually popular. I remember, there was, cafes would all be selling zines in Honolulu, and that's actually how I met a lot of people, was through that. I think a lot of people do it because they're socially incompetent and they don't, you know, like me. Well, at least, you know, I was back then, and you just don't know how else to connect with people. I guess there wasn't Facebook or anything, so it was a good way to meet people. I mean, that sounds really kind of like, maybe I'm making it, I'm banalizing it or something, but it one of its great functions was sort of like a meeting other cartoonists, mm-hmm. and creative people. And there was a nice little scene for a while in Hawaii. Looking back on it, it all just seems really corny because it was all just like, you know, people that listen to Stone Temple Pilots and like, just, like just 90s stuff. Oh, I forgot to ask you, so that song that was playing before that Gabby Pakanui song was more obscenity than I had ever heard on the radio in the States, and I was blown away. And so does that mean that can I say words that are swear words?
You can. Maybe I'll do a little, because I mean we are going to be talking about mature subjects at some point. I'm expecting, so maybe a little listener discretion be advised. You also can't say the "see you next Tuesday" word.
I don't know if I know. So sorry.
Just spell it out.
Oh, okay. Sorry. All right.
So, all right. What got you out of Hawaii? What pulled you out of there?
Sadly, this is actually another really pathetic part about all that era. I remember actually drawing a comic from my last issue of this mini comic that I drew back then, that was about how maybe if I moved to the mainland, my comics would sell better. And I actually had this image in my mind of the mainland, which is what we call the United States in Hawaii, as being this, you know, like, when I get mail from all these people who are drawing amazing comics, and you see Fantagraphics and Drawn and Quarterly put all these incredible comics that, we would get in Hawaii if we tried really hard, it would just seem like cartoonists would be, were royalty. I mean, they're respected as artists, and they were making a living drawing comics somehow, and there was this whole fan base around it, and it just seemed like it was taken seriously. And imagine my surprise when I arrived and found out that was not the case. I mean, I had lived in the States before that, but I hadn't. I didn't connect somehow. Like I wasn't on the coast, so I didn't understand. I thought that's where all the cool stuff happened.
Did you go to San Francisco?
San Francisco, Seattle, New York, yeah, you know, Portland even back then. I actually lived in Portland for a couple of years. And, I don't know, it's thinking about all that, the 90s, it fills me with a combination of nostalgia for how great it was. But it also is sort of an embarrassment for how naive it all was. I mean, there really was a comics culture in Portland in the early 90s. And mm-hmm. There was a lot of really amazing comics that you will never read. You know, they're just sort of like they all had, just like my comic, had a print run of like 50, and were just sort of like sitting in the corner of some junkie cafe, like, you know, bent over and had been read 80 times, but nobody's ever bought it. And then it just disappeared, and that's the last you'll ever see it. And I'm pretty sure, from my memory, if my memory serves me right, that they were, some of them were really amazing, and there's just so many reasons to not draw comics that I think a lot of people just didn't think it was worth it.
Mm-hmm. Well, zine culture, I mean, it is such an interesting touchstone in time, is like, because people were able to just so quickly get ideas out for the first time so cheaply. You didn't have to depend on, please excuse the term, the means of production to be able to create your goods. You were your means of production. You could create it, you could do it. And you know, these kids with the internet, they don't know how good they got it.
they do get it. I was actually thinking about it today, how I just started writing musicians that I've been big fans of that now I'm finding out have blogs, and that have always been sort of obscure figures, but have also been kind of, you know, they're like real bands, like they. So you always look at them as these ethereal, you know, gods that don't actually have to eat or shit. I'm sorry,
bad. Shit.
Seeing them just writing about their personal thoughts, or, you know, is really humanizing. That's something that I never would have seen without the internet, at least not as easily or as frequently. And I feel like that's done more. I mean, I remember punk rock used to be all about, you know, like taking out that barrier between the musician and the audience, and, you know, that they wouldn't play on stages, they would play on really small stages, and you could get up on stage, and I thought that was a good start, but it always seemed like there was still that dynamic of, you know, we're the band, you're the fans, and with comics too, maybe not so much, but a little bit. Anytime there's a creative person and then their audience. And I feel like the internet, I mean, I'm like putting comments on a blog of somebody that I really admire, and they're responding to it. And there's something, I mean, there's something weird about that, mm-hmm. to me, just because I'm old, I guess. But there's also something really, really, I don't know.
Amazing?
It takes all the mystique out of it. They're just human beings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much that I love. I don't want to get a big long talk about the one to the internet, but being able to find all this music that I remember, like one record store in town would carry some of it, and occasionally you'd see a $50 Einstürzer and Neubauten CD and be like, oh wow. And now they have a website that they sell those stuffs themselves, and you can blah blah blah. I mean, accessibility is so interesting, important, and it's really great with comics a lot now, because a lot of cartoonists are making themselves pretty accessible.
Also
remove themselves even more.
Yeah, it seems like with webcomics, there's actually if you do it right, or if you have the right interests, that it's like Penny Arcade guys are making more money than anyone ever made off comics with print.
Except for the Turtles.
Yeah, right, right. I don't know what to make of that. I mean, I've noticed that there's a trend with cartoonists with web comics that are actually popular. Anything that gets big on the internet has certain ingredients that, like, you know, it has either you draw something about video games or cats, or you know, video games and cats. it seems like there's a pretty tight market. Like, I don't think my comics are necessarily. I mean, I don't know. There's this weird sort of culture around the internet in general.
One thing I'm really curious about is the shelf life of a lot of this work. Like, are you going to be able to read, you know, Diesel Sweeties in 20 years the same way as you'd read, you know, a Frank comic from 20 years ago?
Yeah, that's a good question, because our culture has changed so fundamentally in the past 10 to 20 years that, I mean, if you told me all this was going to happen when I was drawing my first mini comic, there's no way I would have believed you. It sounds like, you know, we might as well tell me we have, like, you know, pneumatic tubes to go traveling with, and, you know, like jet cars. It sounds totally absurd. And at the same time, all these people that are doing webcomics they're making books. I mean, that's part of how they're making so much money, is they're reprinting them and selling the same product like three times. And so they're still technically, you know, cartoonists. I mean, there's print cartoonists.
I just mean that of the content itself, of the subject matter.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess that's before I derailed myself. That's where I was going with that. Is that, who knows, in 20 or 30 years from now, maybe our culture will be even more disposable, and that sort of, that and what we're reading now is going to be considered the good old days of, you know, really deep thought and, you know, artistic steps and breadth. And I mean, I know, like, things are always changing. I have a really cynical, probably extremely pessimistic view about the future of our culture. But who am I? I mean, I don't know. I think I can go anywhere. I never would have. I obviously don't know what I'm talking about, because if I did, I would have had a webcomic 10 years ago and been rich right now.
But have no soul.
Yeah, I've got my respect. My self-respect.
No, that webcomic people have soul too. Don't get mad at me.
They do that. Yeah, I can hear people rending their garments all over the internet right now. My slandering slanderous comments about their artistic merit. There's plenty of great webcomics. I mean, it's just a medium.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a lot of great mini comics that are not getting read. I mean, I can't remember who it was, but there's some web cartoonist that had a huge post recently about how he can't afford to draw comics anymore. And that was a little surprising to me it kind of opened my eyes that it's not a magic. You don't get a website and magically you're suddenly popular mm-hmm. and making money. There's a certain market for that sort of thing.
And you know what? It's, you know, as tough, I don't know. What I'm saying is the most comforting thing. But you got to do the work that's right for yourself. And that may not be posting it online. You may have to, you know, just because that avenue is there doesn't mean it's going to work for you as it's worked for someone else.
Yeah, as a cartoonist who's broke, I feel like I'm just fascinated by that whole, like, what that means. I mean, what the implications of that. I mean, I know, and at one level, it's a huge mistake to think about money at all if you're an artist. I mean, that's typically the cliche, you know. It's like we should keep ourselves pure and just to do whatever we want and not think about our audience at all. At least, I don't know. But at the same time, you got to eat, so... I feel like there are certain things I could draw about that I know would make people who have a lot of disposable income want to read. And I know there's a lot of things I draw about that people with disposable income will want to burn and not just totally disregard. And so I'm not sure where to take that as my point. Like I think a lot of us cartoonists are wringing our hands over that lately, because back in the 90s, it seemed like there's going to be a grand golden new dawn of a cartooning, renaissance where we'd be taken seriously as artists, and they'd be teaching us in college and superhero stuff, but it would sort of fade away, and we'd become real adult artists saying real adult things. And I mean, then the comic book market's totally crashed, and Chris Ware was the only person even barely making a living, and then a year ago the whole economy in America and the States crashed. So
I'm totally gonna switch gears, and
please.
Actually, yeah, I'm gonna play a quick song break because we're about 25 past. I'm gonna play Cricket versus Ant, if that sounds all right.
That sounds appropriate. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll be right back. Inkstud CITR 101.9 FM, and I'm chatting with Gabby Schultz, and we'll be right back.
okay? What's wrong?
I've been looking for a job since I came to Canada, and I haven't found anything.
Have you tried WorkLearn?
What's WorkLearn?
Part-time jobs on campus for international undergraduate students just like us help me find a great job that's actually related to my studies.
Wow! I'll have to check that out.
You should. It's good pay, good experience, and good for your career. Just look for WorkLearn postings at www.careersonline.ubc.ca. You can even ask your profs and campus staff if they can create a job for you.
To participate in WorkLearn, you must be an international student seeking an undergraduate degree in a participating faculty and registered full-time, with a study permit valid for at least 6 months. For more information, visit www.careers.ubc.ca.
And we're back, Inkstud CITR 101.9 FM out of Vancouver. It's about 2:30 here, 5:30 for my guest in New York. Up next week, I'm going to be playing, it's July 1st, Canada Day. So I'm going to play an interview with former Vancouverite, now Torontoite, Keith Jones, with his wonderful new book, Catland Empire, from Drawn and Quarterly. And over the next while, I also have interviews coming up with Quebec cartoonist Philippe Girard, going to talk about his book Ruts and Gullies, which is beautiful, as well as Simon Gardenfors from Sweden, and a whole bunch of other people. Theo Ellsworth is going to be on in July at some point, and Ryan Alexander Tanner. Too many names in that name. Good shows coming up, and right now I'm talking to Gabby Schultz, aka Kendall. I didn't even mention the comics you did. We went for a half hour on various diatribes, and I've not mentioned you make comics. You're a cartoonist. Your first collection, that with a spine, I guess, is Welcome to Dollhouse, which collects a lot of your older zine work, which kind of touches on a little bit of what we're talking about. And your Eisner nominated book, Monsters, which I quite enjoyed, and it was weird. I had the hardest time getting it in Vancouver because I Well, Diamond won't ship it up here.
Are you kidding? Really? That's funny, because it's actually in adult previews.
Exactly. That's why Diamond does not ship quote unquote pornography across board. But
oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah, I forgot about that.
But it's great.
Yeah, it's dirty pornography.
It's so ridiculous to classify as pornography, because, I mean, it's about as pornographic as, you know, a Jeffrey Brown comic at its worst. I don't find it pornographic at all. Like, it's mature subject matter, but yeah. It's... I don't know.
It's improper. I can see any custom agent looking at it and being like, no, this isn't going to happen. Too, I mean, if they get to the right pages.
Yeah, too many cold sores.
Yeah, well, and also there's a giant herpes penis attacking a city. Like, I don't know.
See, I don't know. It's wonderful, though. It really is your strongest work, and it seems like you kind of put your soul into it.
Yeah, thanks. I figured, if I'm going to go there, I might as well go all the way, you know? I love reading comics that have way too much information, and those are always, to me, those are always my favorite. Although, weirdly, I don't really like Joe Matt, but I mean, he's okay, but he's almost too self-conscious, you know? It's like that's the only reason he's doing it is to... But I'm probably more similar to Joe Matt than any other cartoonist I can think of. So maybe that's why.
I don't know, it's funny because in reading it and kind of thinking about it, Joe Matt was not a comparison for me at all.
Oh, good.
Yeah, no, not at all. Like, my first thought was like Justin Green's Binky Brown and the Virgin Mary. Like, I don't know. Was that a big influence?
That stuff is great. I love and Chester Brown's autobiographical stuff. Anything where you just comics has such a great ability to deal with those subject things that with secrets, you know. And this problem with secrets is there's always another side to this horrible thing. And I feel like that telling this story of the other side of something horrible is really, the comics are good for that, because it's, you can, you're able to focus on every little, it's like, you know, when somebody, when you, because you lose an argument with somebody at a restaurant or something, and you're walking home and you're like, you know, the only reason I lost that argument was because I don't know how to talk, or like, but there was all these, but I know you were right.
Yeah.
You were right, but just the rhetoric wasn't there somehow. And so I feel like comics are like this medium for the slighted and the introverted. It's like the people that just don't get a fair shake of things, because we can go back and examine every little thing that happened and show exactly how, you know, things really were. And I mean, obviously no one's ever shown how things really were, but at least reframe everything in a way that makes it seem more human.
At least
I want to say more like something in a way that people would agree with me, but that's, you know, I'd hate to think that that's the only reason I'm doing it.
I was thinking more it's kind of going towards the way you envision things.
Yeah, I guess that's inevitable. Yeah,
yeah.
But I mean I really tried hard to make it. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm saying all this like I'm drawing comics to make myself look better, but then I think back on what Monsters, most of it is making myself look fucking horrible. Sorry, with making myself...
It's okay.
Making myself look horrible, like really bad. And I tried to fictionalize it a little bit, but I keep saying, you know, the character Ken Doll did all these things. And the book isn't exactly autobiographical, but basically it's stuff that happened to me and it's stuff that I did. And it feels really good to lay all that stuff out on the table, especially with something like a STD, because it's something that millions of people know they have and don't ever tell anyone about, or, you know, don't know they have. And
why don't you give a little detail of what the book is about?
It's about herpes. It's not a biographical story about this character, Ken Tull, that is in a happy relationship with someone, and then she gets an outbreak of what they later find out is herpes, and it's traumatic and miserable, and they end up breaking up partially because of it. And then this character Kendall finds out he is positive for HSV, for herpes simplex, and goes through the, you know, to cue like 180 pages of self pity and complaining, basically, or like going through all the typical scenarios of what somebody goes through when they have a sexually transmitted disease. I mean, there's like the intense self-hatred, the you know, the voluntary quarantine, and the having awkward sexual experience with someone and not knowing when to tell them, not telling someone and having them find out later. And so I kind of just wanted to catalog all the ways that it's how having this basically a harmless disease becomes like the worst thing imaginable when you put on top of it all the human folly and error that can come with just being an idiot about it. And I guess the reason I wanted to draw all that is to have everyone come to the same conclusion that I came, I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, but
it's okay.
I came to at the end of the book which is that if you just know what it is, it's not that big of a deal. But getting there is hell. I mean, and the crazy thing to me is that most of the world has it. I mean, I had to force myself to learn about all this stuff regarding herpes and what it is and it's like most medical things. The more you learn about it, the less you realize that you or anyone really knows. And I mean, there's all sorts of crazy things about that, you know, common knowledge doesn't support. Like, and we all know that you get blisters on your mouth or your junk when once a month or whatever, people think. But it's actually not true. Most people who get herpes don't ever show symptoms. And the people that do show symptoms sometimes show symptoms that even doctors confuse with urinary tract infections or, you know, just other kind of rashes. And I've gone to, just because of drawing this book, out of curiosity, gone to multiple clinicians and doctors and had them test me in various ways. And I mean, they're all like, I just heard all sorts of weird stuff. Like it's just crazy. Like when I was living in Phoenix, when I got health insurance, I called. I was just starting to figure out whether I had herpes or not, and I called a doctor in Mesa, which is a huge Mormon stronghold in the Southwest, and it's just sort of like a subsidiary of the Greater Phoenix area. When I told the receptionist why I wanted to see this doctor, she said that we don't see patients with herpes because it's, you know, transmittable. And to me, that was really messed up. Like, an actual doctor's office is telling me that they're not going to see me.
That's horrible.
It was insane. I know it was so insane that I actually got angry, and then she put me on hold for a long time after we had this huge discussion about it. And she was like, "When do you want to see the doctor?" When she came back. But, like, I mean, the fact that that even happened, I mean, what, 70-something percent of the population has it. And, like, there's somebody in her office right now that has it. What, she probably has it. Like, what is the deal? Why is everyone making such a big deal out of it? And, I go back and forth between thinking, why did I spend 2 years of my life drawing this book about a totally benign disease that, you know, kills almost no one? And, you know, there's so many better reasons to draw a comic book. I mean, I'm, you know, Joe Sacco, drawing about Palestine, you know, meanwhile, I'm like, oh, herpes is so bad. But it's just the fact that I went through it, so it, you know, it's easy to talk about, and I'm interested in it because I've spent so much time thinking about it. But it seems like it affects everyone, and it shouldn't affect anyone seriously, but everyone makes a big deal out of it because they don't know anything about it. And it just seems like the perfect opportunity to very quickly and easily distill a lot of stupidity and ignorance. Which isn't, of course, I can say that, like, that's my plan all along. Like, I sat down and thought, I'm going to do something good for humanity today when I started drawing it. But it actually started out as me just sort of giving myself therapy, and I didn't think that it would ever actually get published or be a 200-page book. I thought it would just be like me drawing another little mini comic about how hard I have it, and then 50 people would read it, and then I would draw something else. So,
well, it reminds me of what Chester Brown kind of intended with his own work, his own autobiographical work, where he's taking an issue that is awkward, especially with the Playboy, and putting it out there and discussing it, and everyone would go, yeah, I went through that too.
Yeah. Oh, I know, yeah. Comics are great for that. They're great for just showing all the dirty laundry.
It's important to be able to kind of put that discussion out there and be able to create that discussion, so.
Yeah, yeah. And no one else is doing it. I mean, I don't know how else you would do that. Especially with something like anything sexual, there's just so much that's almost poetic about it. I mean, there's so much having to do with emotions and feelings that nobody even really understands, much less feels comfortable talking about, especially in our culture. And so comics kind of cut through all that because I feel like part of it is because it's such a ignored medium that there's just no pressure. Like, there's just because of the underground comics of the 60s and 70s, and then maybe in the, you know, 80s too with Raw and stuff, there's this feeling like you can just, you were not only allowed but expected to really take it there, just to go, and like, you can write, I could have written a textbook about herpes, and it would have been boring as hell, but just being able to actually show a visual manifestation of how I'm feeling when I'm feeling this just, like, you know, soul-crushing shame about who I am or what I have in my body, and doing that visually is just like, man, you can really make someone feel exactly how you feel when they look at that picture, and then when you're just using that in the right way, where it's just sort of like one little chord of, like, one little note to complement a narrative of, like, these two people talking. I feel like that's where comics can get really devastating and really effective, in a way where I've never felt when I've read a novel or watched a movie. Well, maybe a movie.
I'm curious how you came about kind of designing the virus itself as the boogeyman, I guess.
That was because I have a dozen or two pages of pencils that was of just me talking to myself, and I realized eventually that if I'm going to do a long book, I really got to figure out another character other than myself to be talking. And so that was the obvious choice, because having a disease of any kind, I feel like, really makes you start thinking about what's inside your body. and anthropomorphizing it almost. Excuse me. And because, like, I think about that way with my immune system now. I mean, it's, you know, we have all this bacteria and these little white blood cells and these things that aren't us, that are making us up, that are doing the job of keeping us alive or trying to kill us, that are circulating through our systems need a voice. I feel like somebody needs to speak for them too. And to me, that stuff is really fascinating. And this virus is really, at first it was just like, I looked at it as sort of this binary of there are these evil things in your body and they make your life miserable or going to kill you. But the more I learned about herpes virus and viruses in general, I just kind of got swept up in this awe of how fascinating all these little things are and how they are life forms, and they have their own agendas just like we do. I mean, we try to make babies, and they try to replicate themselves, and each virus has its own unique and fascinating and billions of years old technique for doing that. I mean, in a way, they're a lot smarter than us. Viruses aren't even technically alive in some ways. They're just these little bundles of DNA, but they're some of the oldest pseudo life forms on Earth. I mean,
they're indestructible little fuckers.
Yeah, they're not going anywhere. They're they've been here long before we were, and they're going to be still going to be here long after we leave. Maybe not herpes, because they need a human host, so I started thinking of it as this little, it's not a person, but like a little thing that I'm sort of having this dialogue with, and it's, I can't blame it, really. I can't blame it for realizing at some point that human beings cannot resist mashing their mucosal linings together. You know, that's the only reason a virus like herpes exists, is because they have to transmit between bodies in order to propagate their species, just like we want to propagate with making babies. But the way they found to do that is because we're always mashing our junk together. You know, like, that's, like the most popular thing human beings do, and it's not their fault. Like, they just figure that it just says more about us than it says about them. Like, that was actually a huge deal with me getting over feeling like a human being, or not feeling like a human being with herpes, is that that's just what we do. I mean, and for a while I was like, well, I'll never kiss anyone again. I'll never have sex again. And that'll be it. I'm doing my part. And I mean, I know people with HIV have the same program. There's that ad campaign that says AIDS stops with me. And there's a guy that's like, looking responsible in the picture. Like, I'm just, it's not responsible, so I'm not going to have sex. Or I'm going to have, I guess the implication was maybe you'll have sex with condoms or something. But, to me, that's logical. You should do that. Anyone with any disease should stop having contact with other human beings. But, there's the logic of that. If you take it, if you extend that towards all things that endanger human happiness and well-being and population explosion, why don't we just put everybody in a concentration camp that's got any sort of transmittable disease? I mean, why don't we kill all the people with TB, And like, that would be a great way to ensure the purity of the gene pool. But at the same time, like, people will always find a way to have sex. People will always find a way to have physical intimacy, and there's nothing wrong with that. And the only problem with the only thing that's wrong with it is if you're uneducated about the risks. And I think as long as everyone knows the risks, it's part of being human. So, That's my highfalutin excuse for drawing a book about herpes.
Do you feel like that book is kind of finishes that story for you, and it's kind of done there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God, I'm so tired of talking about herpes. Obviously, I'm not, because I just talked everyone's ear off about it for like 20 minutes. But I would like to draw another book that made me not the herpes guy.
Well, let's talk about Gordon Smalls.
Speaking of ranting.
Yeah, I kind of feel like he's like your dark side.
He's like what I'm afraid of becoming, I think. Because I know people like him. I mean, he's actually pretty much based on this a couple of people that I've known when I was in sort of activist circles more than I am now, and there's always this one guy that's like, he used to be an engineer. He probably lives in a trailer or with his parents, and he's really, really smart and really logical, but also you can tell that he's had a few really heartbreaking experiences in his life that have sort of driven him out of the, you know, driven him into the fringe, and but because of his super logical way of thinking of life and things, and dealing with his own trauma and heartbreak, he's unable to really understand his own shortcomings. Like he's always making a fool of himself because he thinks the world is logical or should be logical, and it never is. And he's just dooming himself to have everything always blow up in his face. And I really feel like that's an impulse for a lot of middle-aged men, a lot of guys that are just like, we finally start to figure out how the world really is and how horrible the world can be and how horrible the world doesn't have to be if only, you know, people would figure out what to do. And it just, like, bitterness and frustration necessarily ensue from that moment. I feel like you think the world is a logical place, but it's definitely not, and it's always going to make a fool of you if you approach it that way. Gordon Smalls was kind of that way. I feel like the more I draw him, the less chance I'll have of being him, and that's a good feeling to me. I really don't want to be him. I really don't want to be that guy.
I hope not. It's a slippery slope. Well, it seems like you're kind of breaking them down more and more with each story.
Yeah, at this point, I almost feel like I feel bad for him, and I don't want to draw him too much more, because unless he becomes a little bit more human and I give him a break and have him do something else, I don't know. I've been drawing a couple more stories with him that I just feel like are sadism. I just feel like I'm poking at an animal in a cage now. You know, like, I want him to be happy. I don't want him to be miserable every time that he tries to be happy. So, I don't know. I guess it says more about me than him.
Alas, poor Gordon. What other comic stuff do you kind of see yourself working on the next while, or what can we see post-Monsters?
That's a really good question. I've actually been really freaking out about that lately because I've tried to draw. I've started another book about that's totally fictional about a sort of a leper colony, kind of like a fictional disease that is really, you know, way worse than herpes. But also sort of loosely based on an actual leper colony in Hawaii that they used to have. But I really wanted to draw some fiction for a change, but the more I drew it, the more I realized that I don't know if it's going to work. And so now I'm thinking maybe I should just do another autobiographical story, because people keep telling me they like it, and I keep reading these interviews where people are like, you know, autobiographical comics have been ground into the dirt by all these crappy, horrible, self-indulgent people that nobody cares about. And you would think Monsters would be like that too, but it's kind of isn't. And so, I mean, I agree with them. I'm like, yeah. Well, actually, I don't agree with them. Autobiographical comics, I think, they shouldn't blame the medium, because it's just a means to an end. I think the problem is most people that draw autobiographical comics don't have anything to say, or just don't know how to say it. And so I'm kind of thinking of maybe drawing another one, because apparently myself, esteem is that high now that I think I could do another great autobiographical comic. But yeah, between those two things, every day I wake up and I'm actually really freaking out about that, because I'm starting to think maybe comics isn't worth it, or maybe I should be doing something else with my time. And yeah, I don't know. That's really awful. I have no good answer for that. So yeah, sorry.
Make comics. That's what I say. How did it feel to get nominated for the Eisner? A little odd? Good?
It was incredible. I don't even know how it... I just assume every time something good happens with this book, it's because whoever is helping me get it has herpes. Like, that's the only reason. Like, this secret underground cabal of people that have herpes that are all, you know, like, it's like the Masons or something.
I love
so
it.
I don't ask questions. We're just part of our... We're taking over. They'll all be thinking about herpes by the time we're done.
Oh no.
It's really what I assume. I mean, because it's some people just seem to like the book a lot more than they should. A lot more than other people, and I it's because they feel like I think at least from what people have told me that I'm, you know, I'm drawing an experience that they've also had.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, not to, you know, like I'm sure I deserved it or the Eisner nomination, but I putting me next to Joe Sacco is a freaking crime. There's no measurement. I don't understand how those two books can compare to each other. So I'm sure he'll win, and then he'll deserve it, and then justice will be restored. But while I'm still nominated, it's amazing. It's really a huge ego boost. It's great.
Well, I'm happy, and it's what I voted for. Am I allowed to say that?
I
don't know. What are they going to do? Ban me? Oh, no, I can't go to San Diego.
I'm partial now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for yakking with me today, Gabby.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
it was very enjoyable. Our time is up, and I must depart. So the books, folks, check out Monsters, Welcome to the Dollhouse, and Paper Cutter. What issue was it? Let me grab it. Paper Cutter, issue 6, you're in as well, under the nom de plume Ken Dahl. So, there we go. Thank you so much, Gabby.
Thanks for having me. It was a great time.
Awesome, and have a swell evening.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, bye.
Bye, Canada.
You can check out his comics online. I forgot the web link. Search for Ken Dahl Monsters. That would probably be a good idea. Up next is Japanese Music West. I hope you're all having a fine Thursday afternoon. See y'all later.
The truth ain't no match for real.